The judge in the Lori Vallow case tells the district attorney to comply with his orders and the law. And then the judge takes some swipes at Lori Hellis. New documents regarding that guy named Jeff and his untimely demise. A New Jersey lawyer is accused of some really bad things. A Michigan judge gives a tongue lashing to a guy that is pure evil. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Thanks for joining us. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't, like if you do, hit that little bell, and leave me a comment as well. And remember, you can listen to us anytime on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Now, let's support the people that support Crime Talk. Go to crimetalksearch.com, sign up for that background subscription service today. When you have that service, you can do as many background searches of anyone here in the United States. And remember, you can cancel at any time. But every search that you do, you type in the information, you ask a couple of questions, and then a report is generated and delivered to you via email. And it's going to have information about where somebody lives. Are they married? Are they divorced? Do they have a bunch of debt? Have they filed for bankruptcy? Or maybe they on one of those lists, the public registry of some type? You know what I'm talking about. You need to find these things out before you let somebody into your life. Go to crimetalksearch.com. You'll be happy that you did. All right, let's get to the docket. Let's go ahead and open the record for June 2nd, 2023. So first on the docket, the judge in the Lori Vallow case has told the district attorneys to comply with his orders. I mean, the prosecution will get around to a judge when they deem it necessary, like amending indictments. They'll do it when they want, judge. Don't worry about it. Anyway, the judge, Judge Boyce, in the Lori Vallow case, issued an order, and it says the court has previously requested, both orally from the bench and in a written order, that the state file with the clerk of the court a written form as required under Idaho Code Section 19-5306, subparagraph 2, to establish who qualifies for the protections enshrined in the Idaho Crime Victims Act. To date, no forms have been filed with the court. In order for any qualified individual to provide victim impact statements in writing to the court or orally at sentencing, any such individual must provide the statutorily required form prior to sentencing. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about it, prosecutors. You just do what you want. The law's only there. Don't worry about it. We don't want the victims to actually speak, right? So don't fill out the paperwork. Get on it, prosecutors. Those victims have been through a lot over the last 3 years. They have a right to be heard. And your lack of organizational skills and paperwork administration, well, is not a good excuse. Get to it. Next, the court has also ordered that, basically we're not going to release any of the exhibits from the trial of Lori Vallow. Why? Because the evidence, the exhibits are so inextricably intertwined with the case of Chad Daybell that he's just not going to do it. Shock, shock, shock. Judge Boyce keeping public records from the public. I'm so shocked and surprised. I've said this once and I will say it again. I've said it many, many times. Show me what was new or so shocking to the conscience at the trial of Lori Vallow, frankly, that we didn't already know, that somehow we couldn't have as adults listened to and said, oh, wow, that's really interesting, and be an adult about it and say we can handle it. All right, the next thing. The judge in the Lori Vallow matter takes a swipe at Lori Hellis, and not some very nice ones. Now, Lori Hellis is a friend of Crime Talk. She has been on our show several times, and she was doing yeoman's work out there trying to unseal the documents that were basically done in closed proceedings. And like I said, I've never seen a trial done in chambers. Pre-trial motions all done in chambers. Never seen anything like it. So Lori Hellis took it upon herself, filed these motions to say, hey, Judge, you need to unseal this. You're not complying with the law. And then the judge started coming up with his perfunctory orders to say, you know, you're not entitled to those records because I've now made the record that you've told me I need to make, and therefore that request is denied. Well, Lori Hellis filed a motion titled the Post-Trial Motion of Non-Party Movement to Unseal All Documents and Transcripts or Recordings of Past Hearings Related to This Matter with Necessary Redactions Hearings Requested. So the court goes through kind of a timeline. Basically, the indictment was filed. And then on September 3rd, 2022, Hellis filed a motion of a non-party movement to unseal documents and transcripts or recordings of past hearings with a memorandum in support. She supplemented that motion back on October 13th of 2022. And then in December, the court issued an order upon review of 44 discrete documents Hellis argued should be unsealed. Many of her court requests were already public documents that Hellis incorrectly argued were sealed. However, the court did order a number of documents to be unsealed. And you'll see throughout this order, the judge takes some very, I think, inappropriate and unprofessional swipes at Lori Hellis, who's just trying to get the records. Yes, she's writing a book, but what's the best way to write a book? Well, to get as much information, accurate information, as possible. Anyway, then the court goes through and says, hey, under Rule 32, the court has broad discretion in going through and denying requests. And then it gets to this point here. The court will rule on the motion without a hearing upon determination that the motion fails to comply with the hearing requirement as established by the governing rules. In her motion, Hellis mentions a request for a hearing. However, Hellis neither noticed the matter and served that notice upon the parties, nor contacted the court clerk to schedule a hearing. Now, I can tell you in most of my experience of 28 years doing criminal law, if a hearing date is not already set, once that motion becomes ripe, the court will set a hearing. They will email, the court's clerks will email counsel and clear dates for a hearing. You don't just call up and get a hearing and say, I want to have a hearing date. Now, sometimes in a civil matter, you call the clerk and get good dates, but that's usually in an order. But, you know, since Lori Hellis is not exactly a big fan of the court and vice versa, there probably wasn't a whole lot of communication. And then the judge goes on to say that local rules also make it clear that it is incumbent upon the moving party to be proactive in scheduling matters to be heard on the judge's with the judge's clerk. Hellis is not represented in this case by counsel, but continues to assert her status as an attorney and is held to the same standards as an attorney as a pro se individual. And then the court goes down here, little swipe. Hellis does not hold an Idaho state bar license. The court also notes that despite Hellis's continued self-described characterization as a member of the media, author, and attorney, which titles are presumably included in all of Hellis's pleadings as an attempt to bolster her credibility, she is the only individual that was ordered removed from the courtroom during the trial in this case based on conduct that violated the court's conduct order in effect during trial. The determinations made herein are thus made without considerations of those titles. And then the court goes on and says that even if you had done something, guess what? I'm going to deny the motion because the motion that you make is overly broad, would be unduly burdensome towards the court, and, you know, we're just not going to do it anyway. So therefore, Lori Hellis, once again, go away. Now, she can refile her motions, and I would set a hearing date immediately in that request if she chooses to do so. But you can see the little swipes that were made there. Now, as you may recall, the time that we flew out on Crime Talk 1 and observed the proceedings, I saw Lori Hellis. I spoke with her. She was in the overflow room, and she said that she had been kicked out wrongfully. She was accused of taking a photograph in the courtroom. She denied it. The sheriff looked at her phone, saw no photograph, but yet she was still kicked out. And when I spoke with her, she was like, apparently going to go in front of the judge like she was going to the principal's office. to, you know, apparently genuflect enough and hopefully be able to get back in the courtroom. Listen, Lori Helse is a licensed attorney. She's doing this work to try and get the most accurate information. I support her in that regard. So good luck, Lori. And once again, if you need any help, let me know. Next on the docket, some new documents related to that guy named Jeff. That's right, Jeff. Because if we say his last name, it's weird. Everybody bans our videos. They demonetize it when we say his last name. So we'll just refer to him as Jeff. But I'm sure we've all seen this little tidbit, right? These little air fresheners. Says this air freshener didn't hang itself. You know what I'm talking about. Anyway, some 4,000 pages of documents in regards to the death of that guy named Jeff have come from the Federal Bureau of Prisons in regards to a Freedom of Information Act request. And the documents show that jail officials observed that that guy named Jeff was agitated and unable to sleep and sat in the corner covering his ears to block the sound of the toilet that would not stop running. It's called prison, Jeff. It's a dump. It's loud. It's noisy. It's kind of part of the harassment package. Anyway, as you all may recall, that guy named Jeff arrived at the Metropolitan Correctional Facility on July 6th of 2019. He spent 22 hours in the jail's general population before officials moved him to the special housing unit, affectionately known as the SHU. And this was due to the significant media coverage and his notoriety among inmates in there, and they didn't want any issues, you know, because they didn't want him to get harmed. So the guy named Jeff later said that he was upset about having to wear an orange jumpsuit provided to inmates in the special housing unit and complained about being treated like he was a bad guy, even though he was behaving quite well behind bars. Now, he requested a brown uniform for almost daily visits from his lawyers. And during an initial health screening, the 66-year-old told the health officials, according to these documents, that he had at least slept with 10 female sexual partners within the last 5 years. Medical records showed that he was suffering from sleep apnea, constipation, you know, new environment, it happens, hypertension, lower back pain, and prediabetes, as he had recently been also treated for chlamydia. So the guy named Jeff had the clap. Well, that guy named Jeff did make several attempts to adapt to his jailhouse surroundings. He signed up for kosher meals and told prison officials through his lawyers that he wanted permission to go and exercise outside. Now, 2 days before he was found deceased, that guy named Jeff bought $73 worth of items from the commissary, including an AM/FM radio and some headphones. He had $566 left on his account when he died. Now, the guy named Jeff's outlook apparently worsened when he was denied bail back on July 18th and it raised the prospect that he'd remain locked up until his trial and possibly longer if he was convicted. He did face up to 45 years in prison. And then 4 days later, that guy named Jeff was found on the floor of his cell with a strip of bedsheet around his neck. Now, apparently that guy named Jeff survived. His injuries didn't require going to the hospital. He was placed on suicide watch and later psychiatric observations. Jail officials noted in the logs that they observed him sitting at the edge of his bed, lost in thought, and sitting with his head against the wall. Jeff expressed some frustration with the noise of the jail and his lack of sleep. His first few weeks at the Metropolitan Correctional Center, Jeff didn't have the sleep apnea breathing apparatus that he had used. Then the toilet in his cell developed a fault. He was still left in the same cell with the broken toilet. Now, the jail's chief psychologist wrote in an email the next day, please move him to a cell next door when he returns from legal, as the toilet still does not work. The day before Jeff ended his life, a federal judge unsealed about 2,000 pages of documents in the sexual abuse lawsuit against him. And that development, officials observed, further eroded Jeff's previous elevated status. That combined with a significant lack of interpersonal connections and the ideas of potentially spending his life in prison were likely factors in contributing to Jeff's suicide, according to BOP officials. These documents have been released. Also, give us a little bit of insight into the federal prison agency's muddled response after Jeff was found unresponsive in his cell at the now-closed Metropolitan Correctional Center. In one email, prosecutors involved in the case regarding Jeff complained about the lack of information from the Bureau of Prisons in the critical hours after his death, writing it was frankly unbelievable that the agency was issuing public press releases before telling basic information so that we can relay it to the attorneys who can relay it to his family. In another email, a high-ranking Bureau of Prisons official made spurious suggestions to the agency's director that news reporters must have been paying jail employees for information about Jeff's death because they were reporting details the agency failed, impugning the ethics of journalists and the agency's own workers. Some of these 4,000 of newly released documents also provide some information into the Jeff's behavior during his 36 days in custody. It was reported in these papers that he attempted to connect by mail with another high-profile pedophile, Larry Nassar. You remember that guy, the U.S. gymnastics team doctor, convicted of sexually abusing many, many female athletes? Well, Jeff's letter to Nassar was found returned to sender in the jail's mailroom weeks after Jeff's death. It appeared he mailed it out and it was returned back to him. The investigator who found the letter told other prison officials by email, "I'm not sure if I should open it or should we hand it over to anyone?" The letter itself was not included among the documents turned over to the people requesting the documents in the FOIA request. Wouldn't you like to know what's in that letter? I sure would. Many will say that these records will help dispel the conspiracy theories surrounding old Jeff's suicide, underscoring how fundamental failure at the Bureau of Prisons, including severe staffing shortages and employees cutting corners, contributed to his death. I don't think so. I think people will always believe that somehow he was whacked by an inside job, given the high-profile people that he was around and the embarrassment that could possibly come from all of that. I think he'd possibly been, you know, I think his usefulness had been completed. But you can't really say for certain because it only matters what you can prove, not what you think. The reality of it is he's dead. And, you know, the kind of muddled response after he was found unresponsive is kind of indicative of what took place in this particular case. Prison guards were basically falsifying entries, not doing their job, and in fact sleeping on the job. So yes, once again, a federal agency, for lack of a better term, screwed the pooch. What can you say? I don't know. I'm going to get my little, this air freshener didn't hang itself. Just saying. Next on the docket, a New Jersey lawyer's been accused of doing some really bad things. A New Jersey lawyer was arrested this week in connection with a series of decade-old sexual assaults in Boston after forensic genealogy linked him to the crime spree. Matthew J. Nilo, and we'll give him the presumption of innocence, was arrested at his home this Tuesday. He was identified as a suspect last month through investigative genetic genealogy, which combines DNA technology with historic record searches to generate new suspects in cold cases. Now, the new lead in the Terminal Street cases was also aided by the Sexual Assault Kit Initiative, a federal grant program that helps process sexual assault collection kits. Now, the accused rapist, aka also a lawyer, was in the New Jersey court Thursday, where he and his fiance was there to support him in his first court appearance since being arrested. So Mr. Nilo has been charged with 3 counts of aggravated rape, 2 counts of kidnapping, 1 count of assault with intent to rape, and 1 count of indecent assault and battery in connection with the attacks on 4 women in the Terminal Street area between August 2007 and December of 2008. At the hearing on Thursday, he waived his right to an extradition hearing. He will instead be extradited back to Boston for an arraignment without a hearing beforehand to decide whether he should fight extradition. He's saying, let's get me back there. And Mr. Nilo was, well, he was about 19 to 20 years old at the time of the attacks. But you can't go around doing bad stuff. Obviously, we'll give him the presumption of innocence, but that genealogy stuff, it's pretty amazing. It really, really is. Next on the docket, a judge tells pure evil he should have killed himself. So Arthur Williams was giving a tongue lashing just before the judge sentenced him to life in prison over the Jim Matthews slaying and the attack on his family near Detroit last September. The judge said, quote, "You're a pedophile, you're a murderer, and you are the embodiment of evil." That's what the Macomb County Circuit Court Judge James Biernart said to Mr. Evil. "The only amazing thing is you didn't kill all of them." Now, Williamson had pled no contest to fatally stabbing and bludgeoning Matthews with a hammer and to assaulting his two children, ages 5 and 10, and longtime girlfriend during the rampage. The killer then tried to take his own life by overdosing. "Try to commit suicide before you do any of this," the judge told him. "Take yourself out of it so you don't have to kill people and then try to rape a 5-year-old. That seems fair enough to me. Like, seriously, like we've said this before. These people want to harm themselves? Go harm themselves. But why do you have to hurt anybody in between? It just drives me nuts. Anyway, prosecutors allege that Mr. Williamson, who knew the slain victim's long-term girlfriend, Nicole Gerton, had gone to the family home the night of September 23rd to smoke crack while Matthews was working the overnight shift. Gerton testified during the trial that Williams slashed her throat with a knife and zip-tied her wrists and ankles when she refused to role-play for him before turning on the kids and attacking them. When Matthews returned home from work, Williams struck him with the hammer and cut his throat. Gerton testified that she managed to escape the home with her daughter and was able to call for help. When the police arrived, they discovered Matthews' body inside the home and his bloodied and severely injured son tied up in a closet. Williamson was later found in the basement after trying to overdose on a failed suicide attempt. And in a victim impact statement read out by the prosecutors during the sentencing, the little boy who was found in the closet told Williams he hated him for what he did to me and my family. "You ruined all of our lives. You put me and my mom and my sister through hours of hell. You are evil." Well, I think it's unanimous. The judge said he was evil. Prosecutor said he was evil. The victim said he was evil. I'm going to go along with him and say, yeah, Mr. Williams, he's evil. Next on the docket, our dumb criminal of the day. Meet David D'Alessandro. He's charged with armed robbery with a deadly weapon, petite larceny, and a charge of wearing a mask and the like. Now, according to the sheriff's office, the incident took place at a Quick Stop convenience store at about 5:45 p.m. It's alleged that D'Alessandro was allegedly wearing a wig, a mask, and a hoodie when he brandished a video game pistol and demanded that the convenience store clerk empty out the cash register. $300 was taken from the clerk. Though the defendant took off, the deputy said he was tracked down at a nearby dollar store. That's right, steal from the convenience store to go to the dollar store. Deputies found the Duck Hunt pistol in D'Alessandro's pants. Now, this Duck Hunt pistol, which was a video game, was released all the way back in 1984 and is a popular shooting game that many Nintendo Entertainment Systems owners received when they purchased the game system. Now, gamers also received the Zapper pistol to use as a controller. Now, the mere representation of a possessing a deadly weapon that a witness reasonably believed to be a real gun is enough to put the defendant away for 7 to 10 years if he's convicted. That's right. It's like putting your finger inside your jacket and saying, "Give me all your money." That's good enough. If it's a simulated weapon and a reasonable person would believe that it was a weapon, it's just like using the real weapon. So, Mr. D'Alessandro, you are our dumb criminal of the day. Congratulations, you made it. All right, thanks for watching. Hope you enjoyed the show. Have a wonderful weekend, and I will see you next time on Crime Talk.